To learn more about management of lymphomas in CLL, I met with Dr. John Leonard, who provided an overview of what he tells patients with these cancers.
So lymphomas are tumors of the lymph cells, and I tell patients all the time the lymph cells are like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. They fight infections, and so there are many different types of lymph cells, and therefore there are over 100 different types of lymphoma depending on where the switches get broken. So lymphoma is complicated, and those of us who work in oncology know that we're typically dealing with a relatively small number of types of breast cancer or lung cancer or colon cancer. In lymphoma, the type is very, very important, and the classifications keep changing. When I was a medical student in the late 80s, there were, in some ways, maybe 10 or 15 types of lymphoma. Now there are over 100 types of lymphoma. That, in some ways, typifies the precision oncology approach coming to cancer treatment, and that we've been in lymphoma subdividing groups of patients into smaller groups with different prognosis and treatment for a long time within the lymphoma field. And we're moving toward the cell type and what it looks like, to the molecular testing and genetic testing, to even more sophisticated subclassifications. So, for instance, I think we're going to have 300 types of lymphoma before too long, because within each of these groups, we'll learn even further different subclassifications and define our treatments on that basis. So the different types have different treatments, so we need to make the diagnosis accurately. And I think it's very important for the patient to understand the goals of therapy. And for certain lymphomas, particularly aggressive lymphomas, we're aiming to cure the disease, meaning that there's a good chance or a meaningful chance that we go through a course of treatment, the disease goes away and doesn't come back. On the other hand, for some lymphomas, it's a chronic disease state. They're really strategizing to provide long-term management for the patient, much as we treat patients with diabetes or hypertension, where we're hoping to manage the patient and the disease over a long period of time with a good quality of life, and that hopefully the patient dies with the disease and has a normal lifespan and has a good quality of life during that time, despite the fact that they have a lymphoma during that time period. We are clearly recognizing that there are new ways to understand the disease and its biology and treatment, and I think this is one area where clinical trials can continue to make a big impact. One interesting aspect of lymphoma is that, like most cancers, it is more common in older patients, but even more interestingly, and in some ways disturbingly, the incidence of lymphoma over recent decades has gone up. And in the 1970s versus the early 2000s, the incidence of lymphoma, particularly in the older patient population, increased at least by twofold. So the question would be, why did this happen? Why does it happen? Is this all the aging of the population, or are there other factors at play even over just a few decades? And so patients often ask all of us, why did I get this? Why did this happen? They're used to, lung cancer and asking about smoking, although clearly there are many other factors outside of smoking for lung cancer. There's less of a direct causal relationship or risk factor that we know of in lymphoma. Clearly, the tumor cell genetic abnormalities are driving what's happening in the disease. And as we look at the biology of lymphoma, the microenvironment of the patient, meaning the soil and meaning where the tumor is growing, something about that patient and one person versus another that allows the immune system of that individual to tolerate or to be predisposed to a lymphoma. There are issues in genetic polymorphisms, meaning genetic differences between all of us that may make us more or less prone to getting a lymphoma, and maybe genetic risk factors that are not so easy to identify in an individual patient. When I speak with patients, I really tell them that the main risk factor for lymphoma is a funny immune system, meaning if you have an immune system that is overactive, or you are prone to autoimmune disease like thyroid disease, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, other autoimmune disease, that's a marker that your immune system is not regulating itself in an ideal fashion, and that may predispose one to have mistakes of the regulation of the cell growth that would lead to a lymphoma, or at least be connected with a lymphoma. The other side, immune suppression. and patients that are taking immunosuppressive drugs. Those, again, with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, may be on immunosuppressive drugs as an example. Patients who have had organ transplants are on immunosuppressive drugs. Those may be factors that predispose one to getting a lymphoma. So to some degree, it's a chicken or the egg phenomenon. If you have an overactive or underactive immune system, that may be a scenario that sets one up to be more likely to get lymphoma. So what does a patient want to know? Well, they typically, their big question is, what's my prognosis? Am I going to live a long time? Am I going to be cured? And what's the plan for me? And I think that I emphasize to patients that the crucial thing, there's not any one thing that tells one the prognosis and treatment, but it's a mixture of features. Predominantly, the type of lymphoma is the key factor that defines the prognosis and treatment, but there are other components that are going to change what that patient's outlook is and how we're going to approach them. The age of the patient, the fitness of the patient, the stage of the disease. Do they have extranodal disease from their lymphoma? What are their blood tests? Are they anemic or do they have an LDH abnormality, for example? That could be something that is associated with an unfavorable lymphoma. And then certainly some of the special tests, such as pathology tests or other areas, may impact how we approach an individual patient.
I want to go through your case of the 77-year-old man with CLL who presented 12 years ago. Maybe you can kind of take this case all the way through, explaining CLL as you go along.
Sure. So this is a 77-year-old man who, when I first met him, was in his mid-60s. And basically, he works in business and finance. He's got a family business and had an incidentally detected lymphocytosis. And over time, we watched him. He had some small adenopathy. He was really more or less asymptomatic. He seemed to be coping with the kind of the watch and wait state very well. His disease got to a point that he needed some treatment. He was getting more anemic. He had some small adenopathy and was getting thrombocytopenic.
So before you go on, can you sort of kind of go back to his initial presentation?
Mm-hmm.
And go through the way you evaluate him, what his white count was, what kind of diagnostic workup, and how you thought through the initial options that got you to observe him.
Sure. So when I first saw him, he was feeling well, which is obviously the most important thing. And he came to me with a CBC, so I knew he had a lymphocytosis, some anemia, some thrombocytopenia.
How high was his white count?
His white count at that point was in the 20 to 30,000 range. And his hemoglobin was about 13 and his platelets were in the low 100. So nothing that urgently needed any treatment, but certainly outside of the normal range at all that part. And, you know, at that point, we confirmed on his peripheral blood immunophenotype that he did in fact have CLL because he had an elevated lymphocyte count. We sent FISH testing to look at his cytogenetics and cytogenetic abnormalities based on the FISH because we knew at that point, and this has evolved over the last 12 years, but we know that a patient who's likely to do better or worse, depending on different cytogenetic abnormalities, might have a better or worse prognosis, may be more likely to watch and wait for a while, and may benefit from one treatment or another, which we'll get to in a minute. So at the time, he did not have any particularly, he had normal risk by his FISH testing. He was asymptomatic. We talked about it. He said, you know, I feel fine. This is not bothering me. I understand that I have CLL. I'm working. I'm traveling. And we basically, for several years, watched him, saw him every 3 to 4 months, checked his blood counts, did a physical exam, asked him about his symptoms. And then several years into this, really, we noted that he was getting a little more anemic, and in conjunction with that, his white count was going up and his platelets were going down to the point that his white count was about 50,000 or so. His hemoglobin was down in the 10 range. He was a little more fatigued, and his platelet count was going down into like the 70,000 range. So not a dangerous range, but in a range that we were starting to think about treatment.
What about lymph nodes? Were they growing?
He had some growth of his lymph nodes. Lymphadenopathy in this patient was not a major issue. He's had 2 to 3 centimeter lymph nodes. That's the biggest his lymph nodes have really ever gotten. And, you know, he knew they were there, but they really, and all along he's had them on and off, but they've never been a big problem. It's really, this is somebody who tracks his counts and knows what's going on with that.
So this patient did well in observation for a while, and then it sounds like as things were progressing that there was a need for treatment. particularly it sounds like related to his counts going down. How did you think through what treatment to give him at that point?
So at that point, which we're talking about, that would have been about 7 years ago, give or take, the main treatments that we had, this was kind of just before we were starting to use a lot of bendamustine, I would say. We didn't have obinutuzumab, the new anti-CD20, available at that time. And so the typical questions would be, is this an elderly person who we would have given chlorambucil or CVP? Is this somebody that we would give FCR, fludarabine cyclophosphamide rituximab, or would we give FR, fludarabine rituximab, recognizing that adding the C, the cyclophosphamide, would worsen his infection risk, worsen his cytopenias, but also would provide a greater depth of response and a more durable response. So in talking with him, he was comfortable, and we were kind of on the fence of FR versus FCR. At that point in time, he was more or less around 70 or so, and we erred on the side of giving him FR, and he had a good 5-year response. His counts improved. His lymph nodes got smaller. He continued to work and travel and was pretty asymptomatic. And that lasted about 5 years until essentially the same pattern happened again.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the choices that are available today, but just maybe a word or two about FR and FCR. You know, one of the issues with those regimens is, although they're very effective, they're not that easy to get through. What are some of the typical problems that you see, and what happened with this man?
So the typical problems that you see with FR and FCR are infectious problems, meaning that patients are at risk for fludarabine affects your T cells. So T cells provide some of the protection against various infections, such as pneumocystis. It can predispose fludarabine to shingles and zoster infections, and then other viral infections, and then cytopenias in general, having low blood counts. So with FR and FCR, the biggest issues one deals with are infections and low blood counts. He managed this well. I think the trade-off of FR and FCR and what led us to the FR is that he wanted to minimize his infection risk and his cytopenias. And he did well with it. He tolerated it very well.
So one of the things that's been observed with some of the chemo rituximab regimens, including FCR, and one of the things people like about it is the possibility that you could sort of launch somebody into a period where they won't need any treatment. So what happened with him?
So he had a good response. He was in remission about 5 years or so. And then towards the end of that time period, basically the same pattern happened. He noticed his lymph nodes getting a little bigger. We were tracking his counts. His white count was creeping up. With him more, he's got mild anemia, although he really hasn't had transfusions, but his platelet count was also an issue. And again, falling from the mid to lower 100s down to the 70, 60, 70 range. And we pretty much knew as his white count was going up that this was his pattern again and we needed to treat his disease again.
So he now is in relapse. What were the options you were thinking through at that point?
So at that point in time, again, bendamustine had come onto the scene, and we gave him bendamustine. I think we did dose reduce it a little bit based on his age. We gave him 70 milligrams per meter squared, which is more commonly used in CLL anyway, as opposed to the little higher doses in lymphoma, follicular lymphoma particularly. He again tolerated that well. He was traveling and working. And that was really, I think, the main option at that time that we were excited about outside of clinical trials.
So what happened at that point?
So in that time frame, he responded about 2 years to that treatment. And then again, the exact same pattern again with the blood counts, et cetera. And at various points along the way, we had checked his FISH testing because it's important to keep in mind that as CLL patients relapse, their FISH testing profile can evolve over time. And he's an example of that in that by repeating his FISH testing after the BR kind of relapse, he had a deletion of 17p. Chromosome 17p in CLL has been associated with a less favorable outcome. And it's been associated with better responses to ibrutinib or venetoclax, which we'll talk about because he's received both of those. And so in some ways, those are the treatments of choice or at least very high on the list for patients with a 17p deletion, which is an area that is associated, this chromosomal deletion on chromosome 17 is associated with a less favorable survival and a lower risk or a lower chance of responding well to most of the chemotherapies we have.
So what happened at that point?
So we gave him ibrutinib, and ibrutinib is the Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. He responded well to that. He had a partial response that lasted about 2 years. He still had some lymphocytosis and some mild adenopathy, and then he progressed.
So after you started the ibrutinib, did you observe any tolerability issues? Did he have any side effects or complications?
Yeah, so in ibrutinib, he tolerated pretty well. The things to keep in mind with ibrutinib are that the white count can go up temporarily. Patients can have myalgias or joint pain sometimes, some fatigue. They can have some diarrhea symptoms. He had a little bit of that, but he didn't mind it. Many older people are happy to have something help their bowels move. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that there's some bleeding risk, and so we're always careful with these patients and if they're having any procedures or dental work or other things. And then atrial fibrillation is also a possibility in these patients. So he tolerated it well. He had a little fatigue, a little GI upset, but beyond that, no other major problems.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, it is an oral agent. How do you think he would compare his experience with the 2 years of ibrutinib to the two chemotherapy regimens he had previously?
I think in general, he would compare it, and I think your question really typifies what we're doing in oncology. Do you take a six-month course of treatment, or do you take a chronic two-plus year, depending on where you're going with it, course of treatment? So I would say that he would find that the first 6 months was much easier on ibrutinib. I mean, we were watching him, but he kind of pretty much knew what to expect. Most of those side effects or symptoms are not life-threatening sorts of things. They're not the infection, the bad infection risk category that we worry more about with chemotherapy or the neutropenic fever. So I would say that he probably would say that the first 6 months were easier for him, but that over time, you know, he had to be watched a little more closely while he was chronically on ibrutinib than he would have been kind of set free a little bit after FR or BR.
Can you talk a little bit about the way ibrutinib works and what you typically see in terms of its effect on the disease?
So ibrutinib is an inhibitor of Bruton's tyrosine kinase. So how I would explain this to patients is that the B cells, which are the malignant cells in CLL, have a variety. Normally, B cells go around the blood and they bind to antigens or targets that they go after when they're doing their job of fighting infections. And they have on their surface something called the B cell receptor. That B cell receptor is abnormally turned on in CLL, and that's one of the reasons why the cells stay alive and they proliferate. One of the switches that keeps those cells alive and proliferating is Bruton's tyrosine kinase. So ibrutinib, and you see the link in the name, essentially is a pill. It's a chemical pill that goes into the cell, binds that switch, and keeps it from firing, from being turned on. And so the net effect of that is the cell is unhappy. The cell is less likely to proliferate or grow. And the cell is more prone to die off, either on its own or in conjunction with other therapies. And so the effect is pretty profound in patients with CLL and certain other lymphomas. The main things that you observe on patients with ibrutinib is that the lymph counts in the blood can temporarily go higher. So that's something to keep in mind. If you give a patient ibrutinib and they start at a white count of 20,000, it may go to 40,000, for example. And that's okay. The lymph nodes may be shrinking at the same time, but it's important to keep in mind that that doesn't mean that that rise, the patient gets nervous, we all get nervous, uh-oh, is the drug not working? When in fact, that's just the normal course, that sometimes it goes up like a roller coaster and then it comes down over time.
So this patient then, as you mentioned, received ibrutinib for a couple years, did well, same pattern, relapse again. So how did you think through treatment at that point?
Well, we knew he had been through a lot of chemotherapy. He's now 77, and we knew he had the 17p deletion. And so we were fortunate in that venetoclax, which is an inhibitor of BCL2, became approved in this recent time frame. And BCL2 is a protein in the cells that helps keep the cells alive, what we call anti-apoptotic protein, that keeps the cells alive and to some degree also makes them resistant to chemotherapy and other things. And so it turns out that venetoclax, this pill, is very effective in CLL. In particular, it does work in patients where chemotherapy is not working, including the 17p deletion group of patients. And so we decided to try that, and he's done well with that at this point.
So I guess one of the things that's interesting about venetoclax, from what I've heard, first, it is oral again, and do you see any quality life side effects?
The biggest thing with venetoclax is that you can have tumor lysis syndrome, and I know the audience is familiar with that. When you have a patient typically with Burkitt lymphoma or an aggressive lymphoma, the cells die off quickly and you get release of chemicals from inside the cells. The phosphorus goes up, the uric acid goes up, the kidney function gets abnormal, the electrolytes like potassium get out of whack, and it can be a very serious and in fact life-threatening issue. That can occasionally happen with venetoclax, particularly when the patient has high tumor burden disease, meaning they have a very high white count or they have bulky lymph nodes. And so there are very clear guidelines based on the white count and based on the kidney function and the size of the lymph nodes. Can you monitor these patients as an outpatient, or do you have to admit them to the hospital? And there's a very clear dose escalation where you start with 20 milligrams, go to 50, and over the course of about 5 weeks or so, go up to the full dose. And so quality of life-wise, I would say, you know, depending on the situation of the patient and their risk, it's a busy time in the beginning of things because you're really keeping a close eye on these labs and seeing them often. But most patients can be treated as an outpatient. And once they're kind of settled and been through this tumor lysis risk period, the quality of life is pretty good. You have to watch the blood counts. There can be a little GI upset. But generally, once the dust is settled and the patient's on it a month or two into it, it can be a pretty manageable treatment.
Yeah, you know, this tumor lysis thing is interesting because if you think about it, it's kind of a consequence of the drug's activity. It's coming about because so many cells are getting killed. So it's sort of like a good thing, but maybe I guess it just happens too quickly. Can you talk practically, though, about what are some of the specific consequences of tumor lysis syndrome and how you prevent or treat that?
So what happens in tumor lysis is that the cells die off. They die off rapidly. And so that releases phosphorus, which can cause a variety of different problems. It can release potassium, which causes a variety of different problems, including arrhythmias. It can release uric acid, which can affect the kidneys and cause renal failure and start a cycle of then the electrolytes are more out of whack because the kidneys are not working well, etc. And so that can lead to complications of renal failure, really, and electrolyte abnormalities that can be risky with regard to arrhythmias and other problems. So the most important thing is to kind of be able to predict it and to watch for it, not to give the patient the drug and then say, come back in a month, but actually see them again the next day or whenever it's appropriate. And so the management of tumor lysis typically is monitoring and dealing with these lab abnormalities as they come up, dealing with things to lower the potassium or the phosphorus if those go elevated, and largely treating with hydration, with fluids, either orally or intravenously, and giving allopurinol to help prevent the aspects of the uric acid damage, or in the higher risk patients, giving them rasburicase, which is a recombinant urate oxidase inhibitor that basically affects uric acid levels and is given in very high risk patients. So in the outpatient setting, patients with a white count of less than about 25,000 and small tumor burden in the range of a couple centimeters, you might take that patient, you might give them their first dose, and again, there are very clear guidelines on exactly how to do this. There's a blister pack that gives you the first week's pill, the second week pill, etc. But in that low-risk patient, you might check their labs, make sure everything's in good shape, give them their first pill, maybe have them come back that afternoon, check their labs again, have them come the next day, check it again. And then at several time points, when you go through the first week, the next week you're going to go up, you kind of repeat the first day process again to make sure that that first day, which is the higher risk day, everything goes smoothly. In the intermediate group, where the nodes are bigger and the white count is higher, you might watch that patient a little more closely, check the lab, still do it as an outpatient, maybe give them some IV fluids in the clinic. And then the highest risk patients, those that have high white counts and bulky disease, let's say 10 centimeter nodes, those are people that you would probably admit to the hospital each time you raise the dose the first day of that week cycle to keep them out of trouble and to watch them more closely.
So as you said, I don't know if I've ever seen a package insert that has a table like that that tells you kind of exactly what to do. So it's really helpful as long as you know that it's there. There have been a couple studies that just came out the last American Society of Hematology meeting looking at lenalidomide as maintenance. What is lenalidomide and does it have a role in CLL?
Right. So the issue of maintenance treatments are the idea that the patient has gotten an initial treatment, they get put largely into remission, and then you're going to give additional therapy while the patient's in remission, usually over a longer period of time, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe longer, to try to prolong that remission. So the issues as one thinks about using a maintenance, so if you're in remission and your doctor or you're sitting there meeting with a patient and saying, gee, should we do maintenance? In most maintenance strategies, there are trade-offs, right? You're saying, well, we give you this drug, there's whatever, time involved, expense involved, side effects involved in staying on this drug for a year or two or whatever it is. So that's the downside versus just taking a break and dealing with the disease when it pops up. The upside is if you're in remission longer, then you may do better, and people tend to like being in remission. The question also is, well, do you live any longer? And most of the maintenance studies, at least in CLL and in lymphoma, keep people in remission longer, but don't live longer. So that at the end of the day, if you live the same amount of time, do you stay on the drug longer now? Or do you just take a break and pick up with a drug when you need it, when the disease is getting worse? And so that's the practical question that we have, you know, with patients. And patients, in my experience, have different preferences. Some are like, I love getting to know you the last 6 months, I want to stay away. And others like coming in, they like the security blanket. And they say, yeah, anything you can give me to stay in remission, why not, as long as they tolerate it well. So the drugs that have been used for that the most, at least so far, have been rituximab, the CD20 antibody, obinutuzumab, which is a new anti-CD20 antibody that has different immune system activation and different properties that in some situations may work better than rituximab, albeit also it's given at different doses than rituximab. And then we're now seeing some studies using lenalidomide or some of the other pill medicines, because it's obviously relatively easier if you tolerate it well to take a pill every day rather than get an infusion as maintenance. So those studies, I think one has to keep the eye on the ball of, are you living longer? Are you just staying in remission longer? And is the trade-off for the patient's quality of life worth being in a longer remission versus taking a break? Now, lenalidomide is getting a lot of interest in lymphoma. It's approved. I think the audience probably knows that lenalidomide is an immunomodulatory drug that is in the same family as thalidomide, and it has been approved in multiple myeloma. It's approved in certain types of lymphoma, including mantle cell lymphoma, and it's been studied in aggressive lymphomas, follicular lymphomas, and across the board in various types of lymphoma. It shrinks the disease about 30 to 40% of the time, maybe a little higher or lower. Its main side effects are blood count changes, occasional rashes, some GI side effects, and you have to watch for blood clotting risks and thrombosis. But lenalidomide for some people is very well tolerated and can get a durable remission, and in others you might say it's not worth the trade-off. So, you know, we're doing those trials right now and we'll see the longer term impact of that.
One regimen that you've been very involved with that I think is really interesting and brings up the question of chemotherapy-free treatments is the so-called R-squared regimen, which is lenalidomide and rituximab. Can you talk about the rationale for that and what we know about the activity of this combination in different lymphomas?
Sure. So rituximab has been used, everyone knows it was approved in 1997, so it's been around 20 years for various types of lymphoma, and we give it by itself, or we give it with chemotherapy typically, or some of these newer agents. Lenalidomide, you know, shrinks the disease in follicular lymphoma again, about 30% of the time, 40% of the time, depending on which patient subset that it's looked at. So the effects of lenalidomide are very numerous, meaning that it can directly infect lymphoma cells, it can activate the immune system to make various immune parameters work better, it can interfere with blood vessel formation, it can do a lot of different things. And so the concept is that if rituximab works for the immune system and lenalidomide can activate or enhance the immune system, giving them together may work even better. And so there are a variety of trials looking at lenalidomide rituximab. We've looked at it in relapsed follicular lymphoma patients. There are studies looking at it as initial treatment for follicular lymphoma patients. It's also been looked at in mantle cell lymphoma, other lymphoma subtypes. And the idea there is that the patient who might want to avoid chemotherapy could potentially take this pill with rituximab and have a long remission, and that it's an alternative to chemotherapy, so the patient may be able to avoid or delay chemotherapy. Obviously, this term chemotherapy is a semantic argument because some people have side effects with non-chemotherapy drugs and some people tolerate chemotherapy just fine. But I think this offers another opportunity that perhaps is a little more targeted, a little more elegant than just kind of the typical chemotherapy wipe things out.
Where are things now with this so-called R-squared regimen? I know there's some big trials out there, like comparing it to more conventional treatments.
So there are trials of R-squared in as initial treatment for follicular lymphoma. There's a large trial that's in follow-up right now that is patients were randomized to lenalidomide rituximab or chemotherapy rituximab. So that'll be interesting to see either is the lenalidomide better than chemotherapy rituximab, is it just as good? Or even maybe it's a little bit worse, but it's better tolerated. So is that a good trade-off for the patient? So those data are going to be very interesting. I'm hopeful we'll have them before too long. And then we also have studies in follicular lymphoma that have looked at rituximab versus rituximab lenalidomide. And again, that's a randomized trial to see does lenalidomide add to the efficacy of rituximab. And that's, again, a study that's ongoing, and those results hopefully will be available before too long.